This lecture was delivered at the 2007 Mises Summer University in Auburn, Alabama, sponsored by the Ludwig von Mises Institute.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Up on the screen are the seven main points that I plan to cover this afternoon. These are the highlights. In the space of less than an hour, I'm going to attempt to give you an introduction to a subject that is almost as vast as it is vital, namely money. What I will tell you is what money is, and then what its existence makes possible. I will explain how money came into existence, and why gold in particular came to be money. I'll give you a statement of the quantity theory of money, and indicate its great explanatory role in understanding the subject of inflation and the growth of monetary aggregates of all kinds, such as so-called gross domestic product, GDP. I will explain why, under economic freedom, gold would almost certainly become money once again, and how such a monetary system would serve as a powerful check on the expansion of government and would also operate to prevent inflation and, in its pure form, known as a 100% reserve system, 100% reserve gold standard, would operate totally to prevent deflation and depression, as well as inflation. I'll indicate how the abuse of money through government interference is what is responsible for the problems of inflation and deflation and the closely related boom-bust business cycle. This interference includes the government sanction and sponsorship of dishonest behavior by private banks in the form of credit expansion, that is, the granting of loans out of newly created money. I will indicate further consequences of the government's abuse of money through inflation, namely not only its own unchecked growth and the business cycle, but also capital decumulation and the consequent undermining of the productivity of labor, the arbitrary redistribution of wealth and income, and worst of all, the potential total destruction of money and all that depends on it. As to the remedy, that will be the subject of my class on the path to sound money on Saturday. On Friday, in the economics of inflation, I'll deal with the nature and consequences of inflation in greater detail. Well, let me turn now to what money is. Money has been defined as a generally accepted medium of exchange. In simple language, it's a good that everyone in a society is willing, indeed eager, to accept in exchange for his own goods or services. And once they obtain money, people subsequently use it in order to re-exchange it for the goods and services of others, who are just as eager to accept it from them. To all appearances, it seems that everyone is willing to accept money in the conviction that everyone else is willing to accept it from him. And now for the importance of money. Incidentally, this is going to disappear. I didn't make the proper setting. You've gotten the points, and nothing will be added until later, so hopefully you won't miss it. However it is that money comes into existence, the fact that it does exist is enormously beneficial. Without it, the division of labor society on which modern material civilization rests could not exist. A division of labor society is characterized by the fact that each individual lives by producing or helping to produce just one, or at most, a relatively small number of things, practically all of which are consumed by others. At the same time, almost everything that any individual himself consumes in such a society is produced by the labor of others. Just think of any job you may have had and how specific was the nature of that job and who ultimately benefited from its being done. If, for example, you worked in a button factory, the physical beneficiaries of your work were the people who got those buttons on their shirts or whatever. Then think of all of the kinds of work that are done by other people in producing all the things that you yourself consume, from air conditioners and automobiles to products containing zirconium. Among the benefits of a division of labor society is the fact that the volume of knowledge employed in production is radically increased. Instead of everyone living as a self-sufficient farmer and having the same meager knowledge pertaining to production as everyone else, the volume of knowledge employed in production comes to reflect the combined bodies of knowledge of all the different specializations. And every individual benefits from this radically enlarged body of knowledge in his capacity as a buyer of other people's products. A division of labor society would not be possible in the absence of money. In the absence of money, goods and services would have to be exchanged in barter for other goods and services. The producer of each good or service would have to find some way of exchanging his specific good or service for the goods and services he desired from everyone else. For example, the producers of sulfuric acid, ball bearings, steel girders, computer chips, haircuts, and whatever would have to find some way of using their goods and services in exchange for food, clothing, and shelter. But how many grocers or farmers, clothing stores or clothing factories, landlords or mortgage lenders, have any need for such goods as sulfuric acid, ball bearings, etc., especially on any regular or reliable basis, and from any specific such supplier, such as this or that particular barber or other supplier? Also, how could the producers of such valuable indivisible goods as automobiles or houses use their products for goods of such small value as a loaf of bread? They could not break off a piece of a car or house and exchange it for the loaf of bread. In the absence of money, the only reliable means of obtaining life's necessities would be either to attempt to produce them oneself as a farmer, or to produce goods or services of the kind farmers frequently needed. For example, be a blacksmith or a country doctor. But that would mean the destruction of the highly productive specialization of the modern division of labor economy and the loss of all manner of goods and services vital to a modern standard of living. The result would be dreadful impoverishment and mass depopulation. The existence of money prevents these problems. Because of money, it is not necessary for a producer to produce what any of his particular suppliers may want. It is only necessary for him to produce something that someone anywhere in the world wants who is willing and able to pay money for it. Because once in possession of money, that producer is able to turn around and buy from anyone he wishes. For as we have seen, money is something that everyone wants. In this way, the existence of money radically widens the extent to which the division of labor can be carried. We're not limited to a division of labor in which you have to produce whatever it is that your particular suppliers want. You can produce anything that anyone wants who's able and willing to pay money, and then whatever it is that you in particular want, you obtain simply by paying money for it. But at the same time, money provides the intellectual basis for the conduct of a division of labor society. It tells people what to do that operates the division of labor. Because of money and the existence of money prices for all goods and services, producers are able to compare money revenues and money costs and know whether or not they are producing successfully. Assuming that the buying power of money has not significantly fallen between the time a producer purchases his means of production and the time he sells his product, a money profit signifies an increase in his ability to obtain goods and services in exchange from others, and thereby marks his operation as successful. Closely related to this, the existence of money prices makes it possible to compare the costs of using different methods of production and to choose the most economical. It makes it possible to compare the profitability of producing different products and the profitability of investing in different branches of industry, and to compare the remunerativeness of working in one occupation rather than in another. Both by radically enlarging the extent to which the division of labor can be carried and by providing the essential intellectual guidance for its conduct, money makes possible modern material civilization. So far from being the root of all evil, it would be far more accurate to describe money as an essential foundation of all that is good in the material world. I turn now to the question of how money originates. Money originates in the conditions of barter. It originates by virtue of people seeking to exchange goods of what Karl Menger calls lesser marketability for goods of what he calls greater marketability. At any given time and place, some goods are more frequently desired by more people than are other goods. For example, even now, cigarettes are very widely desired. Certainly, they are desired by far more people and with far greater frequency than is someone's old typewriter. In the absence of the existence of money, it would make sense for the owner of such a typewriter, who wished to exchange it for food or medicine, say, to exchange it for cigarettes, even though he personally did not smoke and perhaps personally abhorred smoking. This is because he would be more likely to find someone in possession of food or medicine who would take cigarettes in exchange for them than he would be to find someone prepared to accept his old typewriter in exchange for them. The principle here is that starting with a good possessing relatively great marketability on the basis of its use as an ordinary commodity, such as cigarettes, a new and additional demand for it emerges based on that fact. This new and additional demand serves to make the good even more widely and easily marketable than it was initially. In our cigarette example, the number of people ready and willing to accept cigarettes in exchange for their goods and services now includes not only the original core group wanting cigarettes to smoke, but a further group consisting both of smokers and non-smokers who want cigarettes for the purpose of re-exchanging them with those who wish to smoke them. Now, the market does not distinguish between the motives of those willing to accept a good in exchange, and to any observer, it will now appear simply that cigarettes are more widely acceptable in exchange than before. This, of course, increases their usefulness as a medium of exchange and can thus serve to further increase the demand for them as a medium of exchange. The ultimate limit of this process is that everyone ends up willing to accept cigarettes in exchange for his goods or services, and after a while it appears simply that everyone accepts cigarettes because everyone expects everyone else to accept them. But the truth is that the initial foundation is in the goods' greater marketability as an ordinary commodity, which then proceeds to progressively widen. The growing demand for a good as a medium of exchange, the demand which will render that good money once its use as a medium of exchange becomes general, serves to raise its value. In the case of cigarettes, it is entirely possible that if their supply were sufficiently limited, the rise in their value would be so great as to deter even the most ardent smokers from smoking very much, for then they would be smoking valuable money. If that were the case, the appearance of paradox would take on a further aspect. Not only would it appear that everyone accepted the monetary commodity simply because everyone else did, but also that the monetary commodity had no significant physical uses. Well, these considerations apply to gold, the actual money of the world for many centuries. Gold is by no means a commodity with merely trivial physical employments. When properly alloyed, it can be made to do most of the things that all other metals, such as lead, copper, or even iron, can do. And it has unique properties as well, some of them of great use in the most modern technological applications. However, gold is very rare in nature, much rarer than most other metals. The combination of its utility and rarity establishes a value high enough to prevent the use of gold for purposes that can be served by other more abundant metals and limit its use to purposes that require its more or less unique properties. The very existence of a high value of gold based on its use as a physical commodity serves to create additional uses for it. One such use is the giving of objects made of gold as gifts expressing high esteem for the recipient. The same point, of course, applies to other goods combining high value and great beauty, such as diamonds. This additional demand serves to further increase the value of gold and to make it still more suitable for expressing one's esteem for the recipient of a gift. The second, and potentially much more important, new and additional use for gold that its high value can create is the use of gold as a store of purchasing power, that is, as something which one saves in order to have the means of buying in the future. I believe that this use, usually described as gold's use as a store of value, directly underlies its development into a medium of exchange. Menger and many other Austrians, of course, believe that the use of gold as a medium of exchange precedes its use as a value, as a vehicle for saving. Certainly, the potential for gold developing into a medium of exchange in this way was well underway here in the United States in the 1970s and could occur in the future anytime inflation comes to be widely perceived as a great and growing threat. This is because inflation destroys the value not only of fixed income investments, such as bonds and life insurance policies, but also the real value of stocks and family businesses. It undermines all business investment by virtue of the fact that it both artificially boosts business profits and at the same time the replacement prices of the assets which are used up in earning those profits, with the result that the far greater part of the additional profits is required for the replacement of assets. However, the additional profits are typically treated by governments as ordinary income and are thus largely taxed away, which makes the funds available for the replacement of assets insufficient. This consequence of inflation goes a long way in explaining such phenomena as the Rust Belt. I know I've gotten way ahead of myself here, and I'm now indicating something I had originally planned to leave for much later, namely how inflation undermines capital accumulation, but I've had to deal with it here instead. In circumstances in which inflation renders all normal forms of investment open to most people unprofitable in real terms, people turn to inflation hedges, to things they can buy and hold whose price can be expected to rise more or less in line with the general run of prices, and thus leave them with at least substantially undiminished buying power rather than actual losses of buying power. Well, gold is the ideal inflation hedge for most people. As a metal, it will not die or rot, as will animal or vegetable products. And as a precious metal, representing great value in small bulk, its storage costs are very low. For example, 1 ounce of gold represents the same buying power as several tons of iron, a fact which results in a radically lower cost of storing buying power in the form of gold rather than iron or other base metals. The fact that as a metal, every ounce of gold of the same fineness is a perfect substitute for every other such ounce and is also divisible and recombinable gives gold important advantages over precious stones as an inflation hedge. In any case, in the 1970s, the growing demand for gold as an inflation hedge was in process of making gold a good desired by a group of people comparable in number to cigarette smokers. The existence of a group of people that numerous who would be willing to accept gold in exchange for their goods or services in order to add it to their holdings in provision for the future would have had the potential for making others willing to accept gold, in the conviction that they could re-exchange it with those eager to save gold. As in the case of our cigarette discussion, the potential would have existed for everyone becoming willing to accept gold in exchange, and thus for a spontaneous remonetization of gold. I believe that gold originally became money on essentially this kind of foundation, namely its advantages as a store of value. I want to say that Mises was very eager to see the process of growing gold ownership continue and firmly opposed all impediments to it. His reason, which I fully share, is that the worst conceivable threat posed by inflation is the destruction of money, however remote that possibility may seem at the present moment. For reasons I explained earlier, that would destroy the division of labor and thus modern industrial civilization. But widespread gold ownership would provide the foundation for the rapid development of a replacement money with a new gold money and thus prevent inflation from resulting in the destruction of money as such. It would be a vital insurance policy. The sharp increase in the price of gold in recent years and growing public interest in owning it is the beginning of developments that, if not thwarted, have the potential to bring about a spontaneous remonetization of gold. I turn now to what I consider to be one of the most important propositions in all of economics, namely the quantity theory of money. The quantity theory of money can be understood as the proposition that the amount of money that exists is the major determinant of the amount of money that is spent. To illustrate this proposition, recall some old Western movie you may have seen, perhaps at 3 or 4 in the morning, featuring a bedraggled old prospector. Imagine that he finally strikes gold, digs enough gold nuggets out of the ground to fill a small pouch, and heads off into town. His new and additional gold will be physically manufactured into new and additional gold coins, which he will spend in buying supplies and such things as rounds of drinks at the local saloon. The recipients of that spending will in turn re-spend that new and additional money. The recipients of their spending will do the same, and so on ad infinitum. The result is that the new and additional money serves to permanently elevate the level of spending. So long as the new and additional money remains in existence, the volume of spending in the economic system will be correspondingly higher. The quantity theory of money, of course, applies to every money, irredeemable paper money as well as gold money. Today, the new and additional money comes into existence virtually out of thin air, manufactured not only by printing presses, but nowadays also by computers that create new and additional checking balances. It might enter the economic system via government spending or government sending out social security checks. Again, the recipients will spend that new and additional money, and those who receive it from them will re-spend it, and so on ad infinitum. I have to interject here that a system of irredeemable paper money can come into existence only on the foundation of a pre-existing commodity money, such as gold. It begins as paper that is not irredeemable, but rather fully redeemable on demand for gold. Without this foundation, it would have no greater chance of being accepted than would the paper money from the game Monopoly, because it would lack a pre-existing recognized exchange value. However, once enough time goes by for a generation or more of people to grow up with a constantly repeated experience of redeemable paper money being eagerly accepted in exchange for goods and services, and observing little or no actual day-to-day use of gold coin, the demand for money is transferred to the paper money. In such conditions, the demand for paper money may not be greatly reduced, even though it then loses its convertibility to gold. In the United States, the day-to-day use of gold coin had virtually disappeared by the time of our entry into World War I. What was responsible was the National Bank Act of 1863, which for the first time created a uniform national paper currency convertible into gold. I must point out that the increase in the quantity of money and the increase in the volume of spending that it fuels is the only factor that explains the growth or continuing growth in monetary aggregates, such as aggregate consumer sales revenues, which can be taken as a rough approximation of GDP, and also the aggregate value of business assets and of outstanding securities in the economic system. In the absence of the increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending, all such monetary aggregates would tend to stabilize. Increases in the physical volume of goods produced and assets accumulated could certainly continue at an undiminished or even higher rate than would otherwise be the case, but the result would be correspondingly falling prices and falling unit costs, not growing monetary aggregates. Well, I turn now to gold as the proper kind of money. An essential difference between gold money and irredeemable paper money is precisely the rate at which their quantities can be increased. Gold is rare in nature and must be laboriously dug out of the ground, almost always at considerable cost. Paper money can be produced at hardly any cost and in virtually limitless quantity. If the production of paper money were subject to the freedom of competition, with everyone legally free to manufacture it, it would quickly become valueless. Having no greater cost of production than goods like paper clips, pins, or rubber bands, and capable of being expanded in supply just as easily, it would soon have no greater exchange value than they. Just as it now takes millions of pins to equal the value of an automobile or house, so it would very soon take millions of paper dollars, indeed billions and trillions of paper dollars. For the manufacture of $10, $100, and $1,000 bills is no more costly than the manufacture of $1 bills, and can just as easily be expanded. Indeed, under freedom of competition between irredeemable paper and gold, the rapid depreciation of the paper would cause it to become altogether valueless. The demand for paper money would fall to zero as people sought the growing alternative of a gold medium of exchange, which would develop not only as the result of gold's growing use as an inflation hedge store of value, but also because people with sums of money to be paid to them in the future would more and more choose to have those sums payable in gold, whose purchasing power could be relied upon. This development would make gold all the more acceptable in exchange because people with debts or other contracts payable in gold, such as a lease, would be eager sellers for gold in order to obtain the means of meeting their gold obligations. In such circumstances, the only way that paper money could stay in existence would be by being made securely redeemable on demand in gold. For it would be gold with its stable, indeed increasing purchasing power that people wanted, not irredeemable paper with its rapidly falling buying power. What stops the triumph of gold, the obvious choice of money of a free market, is the fact that we do not have a free market in money. On the one hand, the government makes the issuance of irredeemable paper currency its monopoly privilege. Its manufacture by anyone else is called counterfeiting and is punishable by law. This serves to restrain the rate of increase in the quantity of such money. The increase still continues, of course, and is still far more substantial than is the increase in the supply of gold, but it does not reach astronomical levels, at least not for a more or less indefinite time. On the other hand, and this is the more important factor, the competition of gold is substantially hobbled by measures ranging at different times from the total prohibition of the private ownership of gold to refusals to enforce the terms of private contracts made in gold and subjecting gains from such contracts to rates of taxation high enough to take away the incentive to enter into them. Another major impediment to the government's prohibition against merchants accepting gold coins, another major impediment is the government's prohibition against merchants accepting gold coins at their bullion value rather than at their face value. Okay, for example, here you see this is a very large gold coin. I just wanted you to be able to see $20 United States of America. Can you read $20 here? This is the actual size of the gold coin. And here, of course, is a $20 bill such as we're all used to. Now, until 1933, when we had the paper currency redeemable on demand in gold, a $20 gold coin and a $20 bill were interchangeable in buying and selling. You could go into any store and pay for $20 worth of goods with one or the other. It didn't make any difference. Now today, for many years, the gold is no longer in circulation. Between 1933 and 1975, it was prohibited from being held by private individuals for monetary purposes. I think there was a $10,000 fine and a year in jail on the private ownership of gold for monetary purposes. Since 1975, it's been legal to own gold. But the problem is that merchants are still prohibited by law from accepting it at its bullion value rather than simply its face value. Today, if you wanted to, you could go somewhere with a $20 gold coin, you could spend it, but the merchants would only be allowed to take it as the equivalent of a $20 bill. Now, this is despite the fact that in the market, the value of gold today is roughly around $650 an ounce. For ease of arithmetic, let's think of it as $600. Now, if merchants were free to accept gold coins at their bullion value, that freedom would serve as a repeated demonstration in everyone's daily life of the superiority of gold over paper, because people would then see that the rise in prices was confined largely to the paper money. For example, assuming for the sake of simplicity that gold is $600 per ounce, what costs $600 in paper, such as perhaps a night at a five-star European hotel, would cost $20 in gold. Because that $20 contains 1 ounce of gold and it has a market value of $600. So $20 in gold would be the equivalent of $600 in paper. You could pay your hotel bill either with $600 in currency or a charge to your credit card, or you could turn over one $20 gold coin and that would do the trick. So here we are, we'd have two prices, a radically high price in the paper and a radically lower price in the gold. The same thing would apply to all goods. A $30,000 automobile would be only $1,000 in gold. It would take just 50 $20 gold coins, 50 of these coins, each containing an ounce. That's 50 ounces of gold. Multiply 50 ounces of gold by $600. Well, 10 times 50 is 500, times another 10 is 5,000, times 6 is 30,000. You could buy a new $30,000 car for $1,000 in gold. You could buy a $300,000 house for $10,000 in gold. Now, going still further, if you think of the gold coin, if you think of this as 20 gold dollars, if you say, well, this is what I mean by $20, I'm on the gold standard psychologically, $20 is an ounce of gold, well, then how much is this in terms of the gold? If $20 of gold buys 600 worth of this stuff, it takes only 67 cents of gold to buy $20. It takes 3.33 cents to buy one paper dollar. Well, it's no wonder that prices keep shooting up. We're paying prices in cheapening money. The problem of the high prices is not that things are really getting more expensive, it's that we're paying the prices in a cheapening medium of exchange. That's the paper money. And such daily lessons, if people were going shopping, and the same thing, of course, would apply to silver, not quite as extreme, but yet substantial. If people were going shopping and they could have the choice, pay in gold, silver, or paper, and they saw that when they paid in the precious metal, the prices were a fraction of what they were in paper, well, that would teach them something very important. It would teach them the problem of inflation lies in the paper. Everything else the politicians are saying is baloney. It's in the paper. Now, what this would accomplish is that such lessons would lead people to want to make contractual sums owed them payable in gold or silver rather than paper. If you're entering into a lease that's going to run 10, 20 years or whatever, any kind of long-term contract, a pension, an annuity, and you know what's happening to the paper, well, why make it in the paper if you had the choice? Anyone who had semi-rationality would want to be paid any significant sums due him any time more than a few years out in precious metal. Now, the rapid increase in the quantity of paper money, the extent to which it increases more rapidly than the supply of gold, this is the fundamental feature of inflation. It's the explanation of generally rising prices, of debtors gaining at the expense of creditors, of exchange rate depreciation, and of every other feature of inflation. A gold money, in contrast, even though it too serves to increase spending, would probably not raise prices, because the modest increase in its quantity would most likely be within the limit of the increase in production and supply of ordinary goods and services, with the result that prices would probably fall somewhat, as they did over the course of the 19th century. At the end of the 19th century, prices were about half, on average, of what they were at the end of the 18th century. Well, the best definition of inflation that captures all of its essential features and sheds the most light on the whole subject is that inflation is precisely an increase in the quantity of money in excess of the increase in the supply of gold. And this definition, incidentally, can be found in Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State, and as far as I know is original with him, and I think it's one of his major contributions. Now, an enormous difference between gold money and irredeemable paper money, which Mises identified, is the radical difference between them with respect to the relationship they engender between the citizens and the government. Gold money makes the government financially dependent on the citizens. Irredeemable paper money makes the government financially independent of the citizens and makes the citizens financially dependent on the government. Under gold money, whatever funds the government may possess at any given time, leave its possession and enter the pockets of the citizens, who produce everything the government buys. To continue its operation, the government must regularly turn to the citizens for fresh money. It cannot obtain the gold it needs from any other source except the citizens. It is financially dependent on them. And the result is that every act of government spending is easily perceived as imposing a corresponding burden on the citizens. Every proposal for increased government spending in such circumstances represents an equivalent threat of increased taxes, with the further result that such proposals encounter strong resistance and are likely to fail. A policy of budget deficits under a gold standard is not an option. Every year of deficits increases the government's interest burden while doing nothing to increase its revenues. Indeed, a mounting public debt under a gold standard brings with it the specter of default and results in the withdrawal of capital and of gold from the country and a reduction in the volume of spending and revenues in that country, including, of course, the government's tax revenues. To avoid such dire consequences, all but the most recklessly irresponsible governments are compelled to operate with balanced budgets, which places them under the necessity of providing for all government spending out of taxes raised in the same year. But under irredeemable paper money, conditions are entirely different. The ability to create such money gives the government a source of funds that does not depend on the citizens. The government now has its own independent source of funds, the printing press, or indeed simple ledger entries on the books of the central bank that enlarge its checking balances. In these circumstances, proposals for increased government spending do not appear as constituting any automatic threat of increased taxes. The government is perceived as standing outside the economic system, free of the financial constraints that still apply to all of the individual citizens. It can finance additional spending without raising taxes, for it now has its own independent source of money. Thus, as a recent example, the President of the United States can appear to give the American people a prescription drug benefit, as though it were a gift paid for out of his own pocket, and something for which they should all be grateful. This transforms the character of political debate and results in an unchecked increase in government spending and government activity. The cost of new government programs no longer appears as a reason for rejecting them, because the connection between their cost and higher taxes has been broken. Political debate now proceeds with the supporters of the programs enumerating their benefits to this or that group, and the opponents appearing to have no basis for their opposition other than some form of inherent naysaying or misanthropy. In just this way, the so-called liberals, that is, the interventionists and socialists, appear as enlightened friends of mankind, while their conservative opponents are made to appear as the heartless enemies of human well-being. Indeed, things go even further. The nature of the radically changed monetary conditions drives the citizens to the conclusion that instead of them having to support the government can support them. For in fact, it is the government from whom they now obtain their money. The government's ability to create money appears as a magical bottomless purse from which the government is able to shower benefits upon the people, not only providing free benefits to the beneficiaries of its programs, but also enriching everyone else. Everyone who receives the additional revenue and income generated by the continuing expenditure of the new and additional money. It is the mentality of the free lunch carried to the point of believing in a free breakfast and dinner for those who provide the free lunch. Its essence is expressed in Keynesianism and its doctrine of the government spending multiplier. An important manifestation of this belief is that Washington, a city devoid of practically all actual production, a city populated by hardly anyone but bureaucrats living on goods produced elsewhere, while doing almost everything in their power to hamper productive activity everywhere, can somehow bail out other economically far more important cities, such as Detroit, Cleveland, St. Louis, or New York. Indeed, bail out entire states and regions and the entire rest of the country. What permits this delusion is the fact that Washington is where the irredeemable paper money originates. However, another major proposition of monetary theory that can be found in Mises, and which is highly relevant here, is the fact that unlike ordinary goods such as coal and cloth, whose physical ability to serve human needs depends on their physical quantity, a larger quantity of money does not provide any greater physical utility than does a smaller quantity. A $1 bill of a few decades ago bought as much or more than does a $10 bill today. What a unit of money can buy depends on prices. The effect of the government's increase in the quantity of money is merely to make prices higher than they would otherwise have been. The citizens of the United States could produce and exchange as much as they now produce and exchange, indeed substantially more than they now do, entirely without the increase in the quantity of money caused by their government. The effect of that increase, indeed, has not only been to make prices higher, but also to work against the increase in the production and supply of ordinary goods by undermining capital accumulation and the rise in the productivity of labor, as, for example, in the way I explained earlier, in connection with the taxation of profits that inflation creates and which are needed for the replacement of assets at higher prices. In other words, the free benefits turn out to have costs, these and others. The public does not understand the consequences of the government's inflation and instead blames those consequences on the greed of profit-seeking businessmen. It looks at the sharply increased paper profits accompanying rising prices and takes that rise in profits as proof of the businessmen's responsibility for the rise in prices. The usual definition of inflation as being rising prices also leads to that conclusion. For if inflation is rising prices, then it comes into existence only in the instant in which businessmen raise them, by ordering the posting of higher prices on store shelves or in sales catalogs. The ignorant public then turns to the government, which it already views as Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy, for protection from what it perceives as the malicious evil of the businessmen. It demands price controls. Still another major proposition of monetary theory that can be found in Mises, and which, as far as I know, he was the first to discover and stress, is the fact that inflation does not serve to raise all prices at the same time and to the same extent, a fact which is not evident in thinking of prices as resulting from a rise in the volume of aggregate spending relative to the aggregate quantity of goods offered for sale, however helpful that conception might otherwise be. This is very relevant to the subject of the costs imposed by inflation to finance the seemingly free benefits. Whoever introduces the new and additional money into the economic system enjoys a gain. In fact, the greatest gain that can be obtained from the process. He, usually, though not always, the government, spends money that he has not had to do anything to earn, and buys the goods and services he buys at prices which have not yet risen at all, or only to the extent his own buying has made them rise. To whatever extent the prices of the goods and services he buys do begin to rise, all other buyers of those goods and services suffer a corresponding loss in terms of their buying power. As the new and additional money travels from hand to hand, more prices rise. Those whom it reaches relatively early, and whose selling prices and incomes rise sooner or to a greater extent than the prices they have to pay, enjoy a gain from the process. However, those whose selling prices rise only later on, or to a lesser extent than the prices they have to pay, suffer a loss of buying power. Of course, all those who live on contractually fixed incomes, or whose assets are contractually fixed in terms of money, are easily capable of being wiped out entirely in terms of buying power. The government's inflation clearly constitutes an arbitrary redistribution of wealth and income, one that is capable of assuming the proportions accompanying a major violent revolution. For example, the German hyperinflation of 1923 probably constituted as great a redistribution of wealth and income as did the French and Russian revolutions. I want to conclude by explaining how inflation is the underlying cause of the business cycle and of deflation. What is involved here is not a direct expansion of money by the government, but a government-sanctioned and government-sponsored process of inflation that Mises calls credit expansion. Credit expansion is the creation and lending out of newly created money, typically by private banks. It centers on the creation of what Mises calls fiduciary media. To understand fiduciary media, it's first necessary to understand the concept of standard money. Standard money is money which is not a claim to anything beyond itself. Its receipt constitutes final payment. Under a gold standard, gold coin and bullion are standard money. Today, irredeemable paper currency is standard money, the 20s, 50s, 100s, etc. Fiduciary media, in contrast, are transferable claims to standard money, payable on demand by the issuer, which are accepted in commerce as the equivalent of standard money, but for which no standard money actually exists. In today's conditions, fiduciary media can be understood as the totality of checking deposits insofar as they exceed bank reserves of standard money. At present, in the United States, the checking deposits in one form or another amount to approximately $2.2 trillion. The reserves of standard money behind them are about $45 billion. Thus, the presently outstanding magnitude of fiduciary media in the country is approximately only $45 billion, less than $2.2 trillion. The $45 billion of standard money reserves is a fractional reserve of roughly 2%. Reserves relative to checking deposits have never been as meager as they are now. What allows the present situation to exist is only the ability and willingness of the Federal Reserve System to manufacture new and additional standard money to whatever extent is necessary to maintain the solvency of the banking system. Well, the existence of fiduciary media is what creates the potential for deflation. That is, the literal wiping out of money and a consequent reduction in the volume of spending in the economic system. This is because the overwhelming backing for fiduciary media is debt, the debts incurred by borrowers when the banks grant them loans consisting of fiduciary media. Those debts, those IOUs and securities are held by the banks as by far the major asset standing behind their checking deposit liabilities. Whenever anything happens that causes a significant inability of debtors to repay their debts to the banks, there is a corresponding reduction in the assets of the banks. Every such reduction threatens the ability of the banks to honor their fiduciary media. A mere 5% reduction in the assets of any given bank may be great enough to reduce its overall assets below the level of its outstanding deposit liabilities. And this would be true even if the banks held very much larger reserves than they now do. Prior to the time that central banks had unlimited power to create standard money, as soon as such a situation was perceived to exist, a run against that bank would commence. The checking depositors who got there first would be paid in full immediately. The others would have to wait for the liquidation of the bank's remaining assets and might end up being paid just pennies on the dollar or nothing at all. What is particularly important here and cannot be stressed too strongly is that whenever a bank becomes insolvent, its checking deposit liabilities immediately lose the character of money and assume the status of junk bonds that are in default. This change in the character of the checking deposits involved constitutes a corresponding decrease in the quantity of money. And this reduction in the quantity of money results in a reduction in the volume of spending in the economic system. It causes business sales revenues and consumer incomes to fall, thereby further increasing the inability to repay debt and causing more bank failures and a further reduction in the quantity of money and volume of spending, causing still more such failures, and so on and on. Exactly this process is what occurred from 1929 to 1933. The system has the potential to collapse to the point of the total elimination of fiduciary media, and in the winter of 1933 appeared to be on the verge of such a collapse. Now, it should be realized in this connection that to whatever extent there is a reduction in the quantity of money and/or volume of spending in the economic system, and government interference prevents a corresponding fall in wage rates and prices, the result is mass unemployment and unsold goods. So if you want to know what the real story was on the Great Depression in the United States, the essentials were a fractional reserve banking system that started to unwind. And the whole potential was created by years and years of preceding creation of fiduciary media. And the unemployment resulted from the refusal to allow wage rates and prices to fall. What would totally prevent deflation is a 100% reserve gold standard. Under such a system, transferable claims to gold money payable on demand would be fully backed by gold coin or bullion in possession of the issuer of the claims. In that case, no failure of debtors could ever jeopardize the quantity of money. Nothing would be present to reduce the quantity of money. Such a gold standard would be a guarantee against both inflation and deflation. Now, I have to point out that fiduciary media are themselves the product of government interference in a variety of ways, such as the government having repeatedly allowed fractional reserve banks to suspend specie payments in violation of their contracts, its enlargement of the supply of standard money to bail out such banks, and all the various measures enacted by the government to promote confidence in the banking system, such as government bank examinations and deposit insurance. I should say also that I'm highly sympathetic with Rothbard's view that the very existence of fiduciary media represents a form of fraud, essentially like lending out goods deposited in a warehouse, which in the very fact of its being allowed implies government interference of a kind similar in substance to the government's refusal to prosecute labor unions for acts of force. Well, I'm going to stop here, even though I'd like another 5 or 10 minutes to tell you everything I plan to tell you. I guess I spoke a little too slowly at points. No. So, but there's objection to that. And so let's see what we can get in the way of a question or two. Yeah. Yes, this gentleman back here.
When Spain discovered America and brought all that gold into Europe, I understand there was a huge inflation. So would you comment on that?
Very good question. In the 16th century, a tremendous amount of gold was taken from South America and Central America. The accumulated gold of the Aztecs and Incas, and many new gold and silver mines were opened. And so there was perhaps the greatest relative increase in the supply of gold in history. Well, even so, there's some sense in which you could say this is a kind of inflation in gold, but it took a century for prices in Europe to roughly triple. And so this is gold at its most rapid rate of increase, which I think is below paper money at its most modest rate of increase. So there can be such limited exceptions, but if we look over longer times, a more normal occurrence, the increase in the supply of gold is relatively modest. And for longer periods, may somewhat lag the rate of increase in the supply of ordinary goods and services, which would just mean that prices would fall somewhat. This gentleman right here in the yellow shirt.
What would you suggest for oversight so countries that went to the gold standard didn't sterilize their gold, therefore not allowing the flow back and forth in prices?
Well, going to gold, a proper gold system would mean there'd be gold coins, privately owned stocks of bullion. The government would not own any more gold than its till money, in effect. The gold supply would be owned overwhelmingly, like 99%, by the individual private citizens and companies who would be freely trading back and forth. This gentleman right here. Yeah.
Could you comment on the bimetallic system advocated by William Jennings Bryan?
The bimetallic system. Okay. The meaning of bimetallism was to attempt to fix the price between gold and silver. To peg it at either 15 to 1 or 16 to 1, it represented a form of price control. Now, that's something very different than having gold and silver circulating side by side in parallel standards, free to fluctuate between themselves. In fact, that is probably what we would need, because the buying power of gold is so huge, there would be many, many day-to-day transactions for which you could not have small enough gold coins. The young lady over here.
What's your take on bimetallic
monetarism? I'm
sorry? What is your take on a country that uses two kinds of currency at the same time? Simultaneously, which would be, in a way, an equivalent of gold and paper money.
Well, if it's gold and paper money, I think that's very precarious for the paper. I think people would prefer the gold. If it's two paper monies, like the dollar and an Argentine money, if people have the choice, I think practically every transaction that they could, they'd want to do in dollars. Normally, the better product drives out the poorer product. Good soup drives out bad soup. And that would work in money, too. Good money under free competition would drive out bad money. The only thing that allows the bad money to stand is doing something to hobble the good money. Gold doesn't circulate because the only way you could spend it would be to have it treated as 20 paper dollars, so no one will treat it that way. But if it could be taken at its bullion value, the gold would proceed to wipe out the paper.
Okay, that's all we have time for.